sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On July 23rd through the 25th, I attended the National Peace Conference in Albany, New York. I've been very active in the peace movement since 2002 and began getting actively involved in the 9/11 Truth Movement in 2004 when I attended an international inquiry into 9/11 in Toronto. I see 9/11 as the Achilles heel of the empire. And exposure of the huge body of evidence that contradicts the official conspiracy theory of 9/11 as the quickest way to end the wars, reinstate our civil liberties, and expose the deeper politics at work in our country. I was frustrated by the leading figures of the peace movement and the organizers of the conference for their near censorship of anything related to 9/11 at the conference. Many of the rank and file were open to 9/11, but the leadership seems to be resolute in their resistance to it. So much so that there was barely a mention of it at the conference. It only popped up when someone in the audience brought it up and one of the speakers unexpectedly inserted it into the program. 9/11 has been and continues to be exploited to bring us the endless war on terror, three illegal wars, torture, secret renditions, curtailment of our civil liberties, a bloated homeland security budget, fusion centers, and much more. 9/11 has been used to keep us in fear and therefore turning to the state for security, and thus allowing the government to get away with all of the horrible things just mentioned, including the wars. So in my frustration with the leadership of the peace movement and their total avoidance of 9/11, I decided to replay the speech by Dr. Graham McQueen called The 9/11 Truth Movement Challenges the Peace Movement. This first aired in January of this year. I had the honor of meeting Graham McQueen in November of 2007 when he attended our 9/11 symposium here in West Hartford. So let me tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Graham McQueen is a retired member of the Religious Studies Department at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, where he was associate professor. His academic specialization was Buddhist Studies, in which he received his doctorate from Harvard University. In 1989, Graham helped found McMaster Center for Peace Studies, of which he became director from 1989 until 1996. He was also a founder and co-director of the center's War and Health Program Committee and was co-director of the three-year Health of Children in War Zones project funded by Health Canada. The project was active in three war zones. Graham has been active in organizations committed to peace and human rights for many years and has at various times chaired the Hamilton Disarmament Coalition, the Board of Directors of Peace Magazine, and the National Coordinating Committee of Peace Brigades International in Canada. He's also a committed teacher and has been awarded a teaching award for his undergraduate course, Theory and Practice of Nonviolence, as well as a Lifetime Achievement Award by the McMaster Student Union. He has currently in the last few years been active in the 9/11 Truth Movement. What you're about to hear is a speech he gave on September 13, 2009 in New York City. My apologies for the quality of the audio in certain parts. It was taped live and has some imperfections that could not be edited out. So here he is, Graham McQueen.
The Truth Movement challenges the peace movement. I'm going to follow an autobiographical thread. I've been a member of the peace movement in my country, Canada, for decades, while I've been a member of the 9/11 Truth Movement for only 4 years. I hope to explain the way I, as a peace movement, have been challenged, and that this will somehow help other people in the peace movement to allow themselves to be challenged, to allow themselves to hear what people in the 9/11 Truth Movement have been saying. This talk is addressed mainly to people in the peace movement, and especially those in the peace movement who don't really get it yet about 9/11 Truth. So, since we're autobiographical, I'm going to start in February 2001. I was in Peshawar, Pakistan, helping to put on a peacemaking workshop for Afghans. The workshop was led by peace researcher Johan Galtung, and I was there as a member of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where I was a university professor. Our host was the Afghan University in Peshawar. In other words, we always work with people in the region in question, in war zones, in this case with a great many Afghans. This workshop went on for about 8 hours a day throughout 5 days. There were 100 participants, about a quarter of whom were former Afghan cabinet ministers. Most of the others were academics, leaders of NGOs, or journalists. There's a lot of interesting stuff that happened at that workshop, but I just want to mention two of them for you. The first is I'd like to report that during those 5 days, as well as 2 further days with NGOs and the United Nations, many ideas were put forward to help create a stable peace in Afghanistan, yet not a single person, guess what, proposed that a foreign invasion and occupation of Afghanistan was the way to go. Most of the people we talked with considered the Taliban their adversaries, yet none suggested the Taliban had no part whatsoever in a future Afghanistan. On the contrary, they proposed a peace process to involve the Taliban, which we do not have in 2009. I can't imagine. I'm speechless that at the Bonn process in December 2001, a so-called peace process went ahead, which excluded the people who had controlled 95% of the country. And then they are surprised that there's an insurgency. Not one single woman that I talked to there or when I visited Afghanistan earlier called for military strikes to save them from the Taliban. Their dominant view expressed repeatedly that we needed to end war and the culture of war in Afghanistan, that every effort needed to be made to end it creatively and with as little destruction as possible. And the second thing I want to report to you, in addition to those comments, was one that puzzled me at the time. A well-dressed male participant, probably former Afghan cabinet minister, stood up after a nice brainstorming session about what Afghans could do to make their country more peaceful and said, and I'm quoting from the notes on the conference, the USA is right now planning a war in Afghanistan. Okay, this was 6 months before 9/11. It's about oil and a base to protect their interests. They will build a base, they will be there for a long time, and unfortunately, our discussions here today are of no avail. And then he sat down and there was silence. Given what we now know about foreknowledge of the fall 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, foreknowledge in Pakistan and India, it seems to me he wasn't just making a good guess. He was telling us what he'd learned, probably from Pakistani officials. In other words, he knew about the invasion of Afghanistan 7 months before it took place. We North Americans tend to talk a lot about our media, but of course our media didn't cover this, even though it was widely covered in India several months before the invasion. They said the United States will be invading in the fall. Well, I mentioned that fellow just to sort of say, shame on me, because when 9/11 happened, I should have had a little bit of a head start in understanding it as compared with most people in North America. So, did I cotton on right away in 9/11 that this was a very fishy event? I'm sad to say, I didn't. Let me be more precise about that. I'd studied and taught war for years by then. I was involved deeply in the peace studies program at my university. I had been to Afghanistan. I had heard this guy. I had no difficulty at all understanding that 9/11 was going to be used as a false pretext for the invasion of Afghanistan. Not a cause of the invasion, but a pretext. I knew the invasion was convenient for U.S. elites, just as the later invasion of Iraq was convenient. 9/11 gave them the opportunity they sought, both to secure fossil fuel resources and to position military forces in strategic locations. This part I understood, okay? And in fact, I think most people in the peace movement understood it. But what I didn't get is that 9/11 was a fraudulent trigger incident of the most extreme kind. Barry Zwicker and I were talking, what do you call these different kinds of events? It may sound a little over-technical, but I think fraudulent trigger incident is a good general category, and there's a whole bunch of subcategories, one of which is false flag operation. And I didn't understand that 9/11 was a false flag operation. So I want to ask a question here. Why didn't I? Why didn't I explore this more? And I'm asking this because I think there are a lot of people still in the peace movement who haven't been questioning enough. Maybe their reasoning goes a little bit like mine. If I had to use one word to explain where I was coming from back then, just after 9/11, I would use the medical word triage. You know, in medical emergencies, you establish priorities as to who you're going to treat first based on severity of injury and likelihood that they'll benefit from treatment. My top priority after 9/11 was to prevent a Western invasion of Afghanistan. I saw this as a continuation of the manipulation of this wretched country. In 1995, in Afghanistan, I talked to a well-known Mujahideen leader, Abdul Haq, who told me that the Soviet Union and the United States both had used Afghanistan like toilet paper. This was a bitter man. He'd lost his leg in battle. People had come to kill him, to his house. He wasn't there. They killed his wife and son instead. Shortly after 9/11, he himself was assassinated. This is a bitter man. Like toilet paper, he said. And it seemed to me, as I watched the preparations for the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, that this belonged to the toilet paper tradition of Western foreign policy. Afghanistan was being used. So I worked really hard to prevent that invasion. Of course, we failed, at least in the short run. We failed to stop it. It had been planned way in advance, and they were committed to doing it. What next? What after that? Well, my next priority was to try and stop the invasion of Iraq. It became very clear quickly that that was next on the hit list. 10 million of us were on the streets protesting that. But again, at least in the short run, we failed. And by the way, far from being radicals, as sometimes said in North America, there are lots of polls taken at the time that show that the great majority of the people in the world opposed both of those invasions. There wasn't anything particularly radical about it. We were going along with most people in the world, which said that a different route altogether needed to be taken to address 9/11. Now, I've said triage, I've said I was busy doing this and busy doing that, but why not at least look at 9/11 a little more closely? Here's what I think was going on in my mind, as well as I can reconstruct it. First, it was the obvious thing that to get 9/11 would distract me from my urgent peace tasks. I thought that it was possible 9/11 was a false flag operation, but that it was unlikely. And I thought that this is one of these things that might take the rest of my life to get to the bottom of. I pictured myself drowning in quicksand, reading arguments for, arguments against, wasting my time, spinning my wheels when I could be out there on the streets or wherever trying to prevent these deadly invasions. That's what was going on in my mind. So I opened a little file on 9/11 and started putting anomalies into it, but I didn't do anything very serious about it. Now, when I reflect on this now, do I blame myself? Do I think I went off base there? Well, yeah, I do actually. How did I know that it would be difficult to figure out that the official narrative was wrong? I mean, admittedly, it is difficult to figure out who exactly did it, you know, what their names were and all the details of what they did, but it doesn't actually take long at all to figure out that the official narrative is rotten from stem to stern. So let me recommend to those of you in the peace movement who haven't done it yet to look at your busy calendar, and I'm not being cynical, I'm sure it's busy just like mine was, and block out 2 days, and buy, let's say, David Ray Griffin's 2 books, The New Pearl Harbor and The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and hide somewhere, right, for 2 days and read them. And then you can have a discussion with us. And if you still think we're all wrong, fine, I'll leave you alone. But if you haven't taken those 2 days, then I don't have much sympathy. I think that there were actually 3 main mistakes that I made in my thinking at that time. The first is the one I just told you. How the heck did I know it was going to be complicated? Invest a little time and look. The second mistake is that I didn't pay enough attention to the process of the construction of the official story and the process of figuring out what the response to the events was going to be. And here's a weird one. You know, like a lot of dissidents, I have contempt for a lot that's on television, and especially television, quote-unquote, news. Therefore, I don't watch it. This was a big mistake in this case. Let me tell you a time when television is invaluable. It's when a breaking story is being covered. The day of, even the day after. All kinds of stuff will find its way onto television, which will later be swept down the memory hole. Watch it. Watch it like a freaking fanatic. Take notes. Record it. It's invaluable. And I didn't do that. In fact, I emotionally couldn't bear it. I came home, I watched a plane crash into the Trade Center, and I said, I just felt sick. I don't like watching mass murder. I said, I cannot watch this. I didn't watch anything more. I understand my feelings, but the result was I didn't even see those bloody towers collapse for years. If I had, it might have helped. I want to give you a few examples of how it would have helped if I'd watched same-day coverage. Let me take CNN as an example here, although I could take lots of other networks. Recently, I've watched the 15 and a half hours same-day coverage of 9/11 on CNN. Watched it twice. Surprised to find that by the end of that day, the journalists are accepting the following as true. One, Osama bin Laden and his group did it. Two, the deed should be understood as an act of war. By the way, not obvious at all. Most people in the world, as we know from polls, thought it should be understood as a crime. No, it's an act of war. Third, it's an act of war. We need to respond with an act of war. Also not obvious. Next, states that support terrorist action are no different from the terrorists themselves and should be treated accordingly. Sounds reasonable. According to that principle, the government of Nicaragua could have legally bombed Washington when they were attacked by the Contras. And obviously then the conclusion is Osama bin Laden made these attacks from Afghanistan, and therefore a military invasion of Afghanistan is on our agenda. This is all during the first day on CNN. And there's a bunch of other points, but I won't get into them. If I had been watching TV, I not only would have seen how it was put together and who was putting it together. One grumpy old white man after another was brought on there. Members of the national security cult, Alexander Haig, George Shultz, Orrin Hatch, even the Dr. Strangelove himself, Henry Kissinger, live from Germany on the telephone. We must prepare to eradicate the source of this. I'm not kidding. It's almost a direct quote. Listen, the point here is there wasn't a scrap of evidence. There wasn't a single logical argument. There was nothing said during the 15 and a half hours that constituted evidence that Osama bin Laden had done this act. I didn't know that because I didn't watch it. I read the paper afterwards, and I kind of assumed that there must be some sort of evidence. Well, let me tell you, there wasn't. And let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean. 3:44 p.m., anchor Judy Woodruff looks solemnly into the camera and says, quote, "Sources are telling CNN's national security correspondent, David Ensor, that there are, quote, good indications that people with links to the Osama bin Laden organization are responsible for today's attacks," unquote. Sources, Judy? What sources? Good indications? Give me one. Judy Woodruff is visibly embarrassed as she says this. She apologizes. Half hour later, she gets David Ensor, the security correspondent, in front of the camera and asks him if he can be a little more specific. He says that his sources naturally aren't going to give us any specifics at this time. After all, it's secret. And he's kind of visibly excited that he is allowed to have these secrets. The most he can tell us is the sort of things they will be looking at are passenger lists and airport videos. And I wish Judy Woodruff had said at that point, "Good thinking, David, but I don't want to know what they're going to look at. I want to know what they have looked at, which has led them to Osama bin Laden, and I want to see the evidence, and I want to show it to the American people, because going to war, David, is a big freaking deal." She didn't say it. And 8 years later, CNN still seems satisfied, though we still don't have authenticated passenger lists and we still don't have authenticated airport videos. So here's how it's supposed to work. The national security correspondent has faith in his sources. Judy is supposed to have faith in her correspondent, and we, the audience, are supposed to have faith in Judy. And it's not good enough. If I had been watching the construction of this story, I would have had a much clearer sense than I did of how pitifully weak it was. A second example, if I had watched television, has to do with the destruction of the World Trade Center. Not having watched the TV, I had the impression for some time after 9/11, and I think many people in the peace movement still do, that the official account of the demise of the Trade Center, broadly speaking, structural failure due to jet impact and fire, was a kind of default position. Let me explain what I mean. Default position on something is something where you don't have to make a choice. It's kind of built in, it's obvious. By default position, I thought for some time that it was obvious to everyone on the scene, that they all thought, that they naturally thought, that they originally thought that, of course, the planes had smashed into the towers, and therefore the towers fell as a result of that smashing. And I thought for some time that the people came along talking about explosions unrelated to the jet impacts, were somehow latecomers, revisionists, giving us a thing that we would have to go out of our way to choose. And I think many people in the peace movement still think this. Some of them say, well, I'm too busy, or I'm not a scientist, so I can't go with this exotic late-coming hypothesis. I have to go with the obvious, natural default position. Well, it's historically false. Both of the positions that are the leading positions on the collapse, so-called, of the towers today were articulated between 10 and 10:30 a.m., that is, between the collapse of the South Tower and the collapse of the North Tower. They were the leading hypotheses then, and they still are. I'll give you a couple of examples from CNN, starting at 10:28, when the North Tower comes down. And I'm not trying to prove the controlled demolition hypothesis here. I'm doing something that I think is easy. Well, it's easy to prove, historically, and I think is more important than most people realize. I'm just saying that on the day of 9/11, it was articulated frequently and publicly that explosions may have brought down the buildings. This was later whisked down the memory hole. 10:28 a.m., CNN anchor Aaron Brown watches the North Tower come down live, shocked. And then he says, whether there were second explosions, that is to say explosions other than the planes hitting them, that caused this to happen, we cannot tell you. End of quote. He then says he's got Rose Arce on the phone, the CNN producer who was outside watching the event. He says, what do you got, Rose? And she says, again, this is all direct quotations, you saw the top of the building start to shake, and then the entire top of the building just blew up. Half an hour later, 10:57 a.m., Brown asks CNN correspondent Patty Davis what she witnessed when the South Tower came down. She explains she was 1,000 yards away from the South Tower when it came down and says, quote, it was a massive explosion, end of quote. 10:46 a.m., Aaron Brown shows us a replay of the South Tower destruction and comments on it. I have to say, I feel sorry for the guy. Well, I don't anymore, but I did initially when I watched this, because I thought, what a weird position to be in, to be a television news anchor, where you've got a certain kind of objective reality going on the screen that you've got to give some kind of account of. But you've got everything from national myths to the pressure of the corporation that owns your TV station. You've got everything constraining you. And you're the person that's supposed to mediate between these two. And this is a pretty raw example of how to mediate. He says, it almost looks like one of those planned implosions. But of course, there was nothing planned and it was not an implosion. Poor guy, what else could he say? If it was a planned implosion, the implications would be unthinkable. The mayor, Giuliani, is asked twice on CNN during the day whether explosions brought down the tower. To his credit, Aaron Brown asks at 12:30. He asks the mayor if there are explosions other than plane impacts that brought down the towers. The mayor says he doesn't think so, but he's not sure. 2:39 p.m., at a press conference, the mayor is asked again. This time he's got his briefing notes and he's a little more definite. That, you know, seems to be just after effects of the planes hitting. But I want you to listen to the question that the female reporter, who's not on screen, so I can't see her, I don't know who she is, listen to the question that she asks him at 2:39 p.m. on 9/11. Do you know anything about the cause of the explosions that brought the two buildings down? Was it caused by the planes or by something else? This is the middle of the day on 9/11 on CNN. This is what people on the scene were asking. She doesn't ask if there were explosions. She says, of course there were explosions. She doesn't ask if they brought the buildings down. She says, of course they brought them down. I just want to know what caused them. This has been swept down the memory hole. But you see, I didn't watch TV, and I missed the construction of this story. I didn't hear these people. I didn't hear the eyewitnesses. I had to read about all the eyewitness stuff years later, and I didn't see how weak the whole thing was. So here's the message to the peace movement on this one. When it comes to the collapse or the destruction of these towers, there's no default position. You have to choose between the same two hypotheses. And you can't choose on the basis of a chain of faith. You have to choose on the basis of a chain of evidence. If I were to think of broad terms to characterize these two sets of hypotheses, I'd call one the government hypothesis and one the non-government or civil society hypothesis. When I call one a government hypothesis, I don't just mean that U.S. government, the Bush administration, FEMA, NIST, all supported it. I mean that, officially at least, almost every government in the world supports it. Of course, whether they actually all believe it is another matter. But most of them, with the possible exception of, you know, Venezuela, possibly Cuba and Iran, but with almost no exceptions, governments in the world have signed on to the official narrative. It's a government hypothesis. The alternative hypothesis all along has been supported by non-governmental people and organizations, or as we nowadays tend to say, civil society organizations. And it seems to me ironic and sad that the peace movement, which is one of the oldest civil society organizations in the world, which even in its modern phase is about 200 years old, and which understands in general the need to oppose government and question government, especially for God's sake, when it comes to war, and has developed its own intellectuals, its own newspapers and alternative media, has a foothold in the university, and all this stuff is somehow, for the most part, supporting the government hypothesis. Not good enough. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying the peace movement should say, because governments say it, it must be wrong, or because civil society supports this one, it must be right. No, it's not a question of trusting anybody, but it's a question of respecting civil society enough to read the bloody stuff that they write. And finally, I said I made three mistakes. The third one is, I was a university professor. Supposed to be a smart university professor. When I was a kid, I thought university professors must all be geniuses. Secret, not true. And I was teaching peace studies, I was teaching about war. I had taught the Vietnam War to students, I had taught the Gulf of Tonkin incident to students. I knew about fraudulent trigger incidents. The Gulf of Tonkin incident was entirely fraudulent, but was used to trigger a war between the United States and much of Southeast Asia. You know, a digression here, in ancient Rome, when war was decided upon, a priest was sent into the temple of Mars, the war god. He would shake the sacred spears and say, Mars Vigila, meaning wake up, god of war, wake up. And off would go the Roman legions to devastate some place or other and add it to the empire. And it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that in August 1964, Lyndon Johnson came into Congress with his fraudulent Gulf of Tonkin incident and shook the sacred spears. He said, Mars Vigila. And Congress stood up almost to a person and said, yes, wake up, God of War. The vote was 414-0 in the House of Representatives, 88-2 in the Senate. And the God of War woke up, and by the time he was finished with Southeast Asia, millions of people were wounded and dead, and whole ecosystems had been destroyed. That's what war does, and that's what a fraudulent trigger incident does, and I should have known. Not only does this lead to death of the enemy, of course, war fraudulent trigger incidents lead to the restriction of civil rights at home. This is not a new insight. This is what war does. It doesn't just harm those attacked, it harms the host society. And I'm going to quote David Dodge here, who founded what is often said to be the oldest peace society in the modern peace movement, in New York City, the New York Peace Society, which he founded in 1815. And he understood this principle. This is what he said. To inflame a mild republic with the spirit of war is putting all its liberties to the utmost hazard. I don't know what David Dodge would think of his mild republic today.
You've just been listening to the first part of a speech by Dr. Graham McQueen called The 9/11 Truth Movement Challenges the Peace Movement. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of the speech. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.